Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. We start the program today with science and intrigue. Modern technology and ancient curses. In 2015, Douglas Preston climbed aboard a rickety single-engine plane carrying laser technology on loan from NASA that could help map the terrain under the dense rainforest canopy. He was looking for a lost civilization. What he discovered was life-changing. Douglas Preston's new book is called The Lost City of the Monkey God, A True Story. He joins us on the line now from New Mexico. Douglas Preston, welcome to In the Moment.
Thank you.
Well, this is a nail-biting story from start to finish. Tell me about, let's start with the mythology of the ancient white city to begin with, to put it into some context.
Well, it's incredible to think that a lost city could still be discovered somewhere on the surface of the earth in the 21st century, but that's exactly what happened. But the legend goes back 500 years to the time of Cortez, when he wrote a letter to the Emperor Charles V, saying that he'd heard rumors of a great civilization somewhere in the interior of Honduras. And ever since then, there have been stories, tales, legends of this mythical city, sometimes called the White City, La Ciudad Blanca, or the Lost City of the Monkey God. And many people have searched for it, especially in the 20th century, crazy people, obsessives, treasure hunters, and even legitimate archaeologists. But in 2012, one of these searches used a tremendously advanced technology called LIDAR, which can actually map the ground under the densest rainforest canopy. And I was part of this expedition, and we surveyed three unexplored valleys deep in these mountains in Honduras, uninhabited mountains, and found a lost city. It was a tremendous surprise. I actually didn't think we were going to find anything. But
tell me about the technology. Tell me about the technology and the process. So you're in a helicopter. You're flying over, and what are you looking for? You know, how clearly is this technology showing you that there's something worth exploring further?
Well, it's the technology. Actually, it's $1 million machine that fills up the entire fuselage of a small plane. And the plane flies in a lawnmower pattern over the jungle canopy, firing hundreds of thousands of laser beams a second into the canopy below. These are harmless lasers, by the way, and measuring the reflection. And even in the thickest canopy, there's some little holes where a laser beam will reach the ground and come back up. And then using powerful computers, are able to remove the tree cover of the reflection
wow.
of the trees to map what's on the ground, and it's actually incredibly clear. It's hard to believe, but the resolution is something like 3 feet. So
wow.
You can see everything. You can see pyramids. You can see roads, plazas, buildings, everything.
So what's that moment like on the helicopter? Are you there when you first find it, or is it something you hear secondhand, personally?
Well, you can't see. As you're mapping, you're collecting raw data, so you can't see anything. There's no
okay.
computer screen showing you what you're looking at. The data had to be uploaded to Houston, to the National Center for Airborne Laser Mapping, where it was crunched by computers. And then it was downloaded back to Honduras, where our expedition was based. And I'll never forget that morning. It was May 5th, 2012, and we heard a shout from one of the engineers. He was absolutely beside himself. He said, "Oh my God, look at this! There's a city. There's something." And we all rushed in and looked. And you didn't have to be an archaeologist to see the pyramids, the earthworks, everything. It was remarkable.
So then you have to get there, right? I mean,
yes,
that's the logical next step, and that must take a lot of planning and sort of conversations about what is the right thing to do with this information now.
Yeah, that's the hard part, the tricky part. So in
2015, to say the least.
Yes.
Go ahead.
In 2015, we, working with the Honduran government, put together a joint Honduran-American expedition into the valley, which the name of the valley is Target 1. It had no formal name. This area had never been mapped before. And we ground-truthed the archaeological features. That's an archaeological term meaning, you know, you have to see what's on the ground before it's a real discovery. And it was amazing. We spent 9 days in the jungle exploring the city. We found wonderful things. The valley itself was truly like a lost world. The animals had never seen people before. They wandered about unafraid. They'd never been hunted. There were big cats, mountain lions and jaguars that prowled about at night. There were monkeys that came down out of the trees and were fascinated with us and also angry at us and even tried to drive us out. It was the most amazing experience of my life.
So I don't want to be too sensational, but before you even go into this jungle, you know, you sort of have this briefing and they tell you about this snake. And please tell me about the snake, because the things that this snake is capable of doing would pretty much have sent me, you know, back home with my suitcase packing. So I just think that it's worth exploring what some of those risks actually were before you went in.
Well, the area was known for an extraordinary density of venomous snakes, and in one in particular called the Fer-de-Lance, which is the deadliest snake in the New World. It kills more people than any other snake. It's about 1,000 times more toxic than a rattlesnake, and it's also very aggressive. So we had to wear snake protection at all times. But in the first night, I remember walking past the hammock of one of our expedition members at night. My flashlight illuminated a gigantic snake coiled up in striking position, his head tracking me, his tongue flicking in and out. And I'd walked by him twice. And so I called out, "Hey, you guys, there's a really big snake here." And the expedition leader with everyone else came over. And Woody, who was the expedition leader, said, "My God, that's the largest Fer-de-Lance I've ever seen. I'm going to move it."
Oh,
I thought, how is he going to move this snake? Well, he cut a 7-foot snake stick and he pinned the snake with it. And at that point, it exploded and uncoiled and was striking everywhere and venom flying through the night air. And its fangs were over an inch long. I mean, it was so enraged. And he wrestled with the snake for a while. He finally got his hand behind its head, but it was twisting its head about, expelling venom all over the back of his hand as it tried to bite him.
Wow.
And so and the snake was bigger than he was. It was incredible. So he wrestled the snake to the ground and cut off its head.
Oh, my.
And even after that had happened, the headless snake continued to fight and tried to crawl off into the jungle, and the head was snapping and spitting venom. And so he washed off his hands. This guy was a Brit, by the way. He washed off his hands, and then he said, "Nothing like that to concentrate the mind, is there?"
Oh, God. And Woody has seen some snakes, and he's lost some friends to this snake in the past. It can shoot its venom like 6 feet long, and you really can't, you know, be medevaced very quickly from this area. So you know this going in, and you know what's at stake. How did you sort of personally make the decision to say yes to this as a writer, you know, as part of this expedition?
Well, I was, I'll be honest with you. I heard all these horror stories about this area that is the most dangerous jungle in the world and on and on. And I thought to myself, well, they're just trying to scare us. There's, you know, I've spent most of my life outdoors. You know, I'm an outdoors person. I've always lived in rural areas. And I thought, well, you know, this is all for the benefit of the city people on the expedition. Well, when we got into the area, I realized there was no exaggeration here. Mm. In fact, it was far worse than they'd even made it out to be. It even surprised the three expedition leaders we had who were a British, they were ex-SAS, some of the world's leaders in knowledge of jungle exploration, were shocked about how dangerous it was. I mean, the quicksand almost took one of our people, sinking, just like out of a B-movie, sinking down into the mud. It rained constantly. There were insects. We were covered with insects for 9 days, and we were soaked for 9 days. I mean, the clothes were rotting on our bodies, even though we tried to do everything we could to keep clean. It was, and then the poisonous snakes, jaguars prowling about our tents at night, the very steep hills that sometimes we had to set up fixed ropes to get up and down. You know, thorns, bushes that ripped us apart. I mean, just it goes on and on.
If you're just joining us and you're all in on this story, I want to tell you who you're listening to. This is Douglas Preston, and his new book is called The Lost City of the Monkey God, A True Story. He's a writer. He's taught writing at Princeton University. He's worked as a writer and editor for the American Museum of Natural History. He's written for The New Yorker, The Atlantic, Smithsonian Magazine, National Geographic, etc. And this book is, you know, it's almost like you couldn't make this up, and how much of a nail biter is. But then also these are deep issues of science and technology, archaeology, discovery in the modern world. A lot of themes to wrestle with. And I wanted to ask you, as someone who has taught writing, looking at this narrative nonfiction, how did you, was this a story that was just easy to tell because so much happened that it told itself? Or was it difficult to sort of wrestle it into a form that would do the story itself and the discovery justice?
Well, it was the difficulty was trying to tell the story without making it sound impossible or improbable. I mean,
right.
Things happened that if you put them in a novel, the editor would say, look, this is could never happen. This is unrealistic. You know, you got to, you know, think again here. But stuff happened that was really beyond belief. And so the key in writing this book was to keep it cool, you know, to keep it, to try not to, you know, let the story run away with itself. Now, it is true, you know, if you're decapitating snakes or you're sinking into mud or you're dealing with, you know, deadly and incurable tropical disease, those are pretty exciting subjects. You don't have to pump them up. You don't have to exaggerate. You just have to tell the story. The difficulty with the book was that this is a story not only about the history of this legendary city, but it's also a story about high technology and how it works. And then it's a story about archaeology and how archaeologists work, the discovery of a city, the excavation of the wonderful things we found. And then at the end of the book, it turns into a medical mystery as the expedition members one by one fall ill from a, as I mentioned, a deadly and incurable tropical disease, because it turns out that the valley was a hot zone. And so the trick was sort of covering all those subjects without losing the reader, who was like, wow, we're going from archaeology to medical science to, you know, high tech to history. You want to carry the reader along in the story.
Right. This you have called this the greatest adventure of your life, but also, as you mentioned, the medical mystery. This, you are one of those team members who is thrown into a disease that has little research behind it and no known cure. So did you have thoughts at some point that it wasn't worth what you had put at risk there?
You know, I can say without hesitation that it was totally worth it. The experience was one that was absolutely unique, that will be with me for the rest of my life, and I got a wonderful book out of it. And, okay, well, you know, I got also an incurable disease out of it, but, you know, there are a lot of people out there dealing with far worse, you know, people with cancer and things like that, and I just feel really fortunate that I wasn't bitten by a fertilance, because that would have been not worth it. I mean, first, I'd probably be dead, and if not dead, they have to amputate the limb that got bitten. So, you know, that's...
How do you decide how close...
could have happened.
How do you decide how close to the edge you're willing to go?
Well, part of it's just sheer ignorance. I mean, you know, if I was totally... I've done a lot of, you know, as a journalist, I've done a lot of dangerous things in my life. Some that were maybe even as dangerous as this, although I didn't get caught. So I feel like if this is the worst that's going to happen to me, I'm probably ahead of the game. I've lived a very exciting life, hope to do more things as well. So all in all, I think it's okay. You know, this disease is it's an awful disease, and I don't want to, you know, spoil the appetite of your listeners by describing it, but it's a it's a parasite that's also called white leprosy. Its scientific name is mucosal leishmaniasis. It's a parasite that gets into your skin and migrates to your face, and essentially eats away your nose and lips until they fall off, leaving your face an open sore. And then eventually, in the final stages of the disease, it eats away the bones of your face, making a hole, and then you die. But I'm getting excellent medical care, so I'm not going to have that outcome, hopefully. And I feel great, you know. I don't feel sick right now, so I'm good.
Has it limited what you can do as a journalist going forward?
No, not at all. Not at all. If the disease is under control now, if it comes back, then I'll have a problem. But for now, I'm good. So it's in remission. So we're good. I mean, you know, to be honest with you, there are other members of the expedition who are doing far worse. There's one fellow, one of the archaeologists, is really sick and may never recover. And so I'm really worried about him. I mean, I don't mean to make light of this. This is a serious disease.
Right.
But, you know, the doctors are doing the best they can.
I want to make sure we talk about the cultural heritage of the site itself and sort of what happens post-discovery. What can you tell me about what happens next to this lost city that has now been found?
Well, the city is cloaked in some of the densest jungle in the world, so dense that I remember standing at the base of the main pyramid 10 feet from it, and I couldn't see it. You know, this jungle, if you were to put this jungle down in Times Square and put yourself in the middle of it, you would not be able to see the buildings around you. You would have no idea that you're in a city. So that was sort of frustrating, to be in this incredible city and to not be able to see anything. But there were artifacts, beautiful. I'll never forget, at the base of the pyramid, we found a cache of stone sculptures, just the tops of which were peeking above the ground, of jaguars and vultures and snakes and monkeys, that were extraordinarily beautiful stone carved sculptures. And that area, this cache, was an offering to the gods, made by these very mysterious people. And that little area was excavated, and they removed 500 sculptures, which are now on display in the National Museum in the capital city of Honduras. Also, some are at the American Embassy in Honduras for Americans to see. Beautiful pieces. But the rest of the city is probably going to remain as is. The Hondurans realize that this is an extraordinarily untouched, pristine archaeological site, never been looted. Its existence was completely unknown until now. And wisely, they're just guarding it. They have soldiers there guarding the site, and they're kind of going to leave it, most of it, just as it is. But it will be a researched and studied for many decades to come.
This is a high crime area, too, a drug trafficking area. There are risks not only from the animals, but from humans. Do you think the Honduran government is prepared to really protect the site from potential looting or destruction?
Well, the site is this whole area of La Mosquitia, which is this 30,000 square mile area of jungle and swamp, is the major cocaine transshipment point between South America and the United States. But this particular area is so deep in the jungle and so remote, and there's no way to get in there except with a helicopter, that it's protected by the jungle itself. Mm. So the key here in protecting the site is to protect the jungle, to preserve the rainforest, because that's what prevents criminals and loggers and drug narco traffickers from coming in here and looting the place. So the government of Honduras now, under the current president, Hernandez, is making a tremendous effort, because of this discovery, to shut down the illegal logging, the illegal deforestation that's been eating away at this jungle, to shut it down and even roll it back and try reforesting these areas. And that's the best way to protect the archaeological sites, especially this one. Now, there's Conservation International has become involved. That's one of the world's leading conservation organizations. They sent 14 biologists down there who just came back last week and reported that it's one of the most remarkable and unique tropical rainforest areas in the entire world. They saw species of animals, of plants, that they never knew that they would ever see. One of the experts, a Honduran expert in La Mosquitia, said he was weeping with joy when he saw what was there, how unspoiled and untouched it was. So it's really a matter of great urgency to protect this area. And thank God we found this archaeological site, because that has provided the stimulus for protecting the area, whereas before it was just ignored. I mean, people were logging. I mean, this is supposedly, this whole area is a giant protected biosphere reserve, but it was completely ignored. There was no enforcement. Now there is.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. My guest is Douglas Preston. His new book is called The Lost City of the Monkey God, A True Story. He's a writer that's written for The New Yorker, Harper's, National Geographic, and other publications. And Douglas, I'm wondering if we can talk about, when you talk about how important it is that this site has been discovered, certainly some pretty high-tech assistance was used. What's the tension between technology and the archaeology community when it comes to, you know, that sort of discovery and how it was done?
Yes, a very interesting question. The city was discovered not by archaeologists, but the team were geoengineers from the National Center for Airborne Laser Mapping. You know, these are all scientists, they're engineers, they're not archaeologists. So when the initial announcement was made, there were some in the archaeological old guard who were really quite upset about it. They felt that, first of all, the technology LIDAR is so expensive that it's really not affordable by most archaeologists. So there was some controversy about that. However, you know, archaeologists are starting to realize, especially the young ones who are embracing it enthusiastically, that LIDAR is the archaeology of the future. You can survey a site and get an incredibly detailed map of it and not move one single pebble. Now, that's important, because archaeology used to be you had to dig, you had to move stuff around, you had to disturb the site. And this is the beauty of this technology. You can map an entire city without even setting foot in it. And that's a wonderful advance. One archaeologist said it's the greatest archaeological advance since carbon-14 dating.
Wow.
So I think archaeologists, you know, the old guard was, it's a disruptive technology, like so many disruptive, you know, new technologies in our modern world. But the younger archaeologists are just embracing it with enthusiasm.
Do we have an idea of who built the city? I mean, do we have a general notion?
We do, a very general notion. The Honduran archaeologist, I remember asking him that question, and he said, well, what we know about this culture is nothing.
Well,
but we do know something. I mean, that's a bit of an exaggeration. This very great and sophisticated civilization occupied 10,000 square miles of some of the most hostile jungle territory in Central America along the frontier of the Maya. So their neighbors were the great Maya, was the great Mayan city of Copan. And this culture took a number of aspects of Maya culture. They built pyramids. They actually had played the Mesoamerican ball game, the famed game. It was a religious ritual, really, where sometimes the losing team lost their heads. And they took on other aspects of Maya society, but they themselves were not Maya. They were probably related to the great kingdoms in the south, in Colombia, the Muisca, who made these beautiful gold objects and were the source of the El Dorado legend. At least that's what archaeologists believe. But who they really were, where they came from, and how they lived in this jungle environment, and then why their civilization vanished so abruptly, these are still questions that are being researched.
What's left to be discovered that this new technology might help unearth?
Well, the LIDAR surveys of these three valleys in 2012 actually uncovered two cities, one in T1 and an even larger one in T3. It appears from this that, in fact, there were many cities in these incredibly rugged mountainous jungles. and so that there are many more to be discovered. This is an area that remains one of the least explored areas in archaeology in the world, totally overshadowed by the Maya just to the west of them. So a lot more remains to be done. I mean, the second city found in T3 hasn't even been explored yet. It's still sitting there. And in fact, 50% or more of the city of T1 is yet to be explored. But human beings have not set foot in these ruins, modern humans. So it's going to be centuries, really, before we understand what was going on. And hopefully the rainforest will continue to protect these sites as archaeologists continue to do their research.
What's next for you? Where are you going next? What's your next? Yeah.
I'm going to sit by the fire and take a glass of wine for a while, I think.
I would like that for you. Read a good book.
Yes, exactly. There's so many good books out there. I was actually just in Honduras. I only got back 2 days ago where I there was a ceremony at the American Embassy, a presentation of the book, and the president of Honduras came, and he's very, very happy about this discovery because, you know, the world press, including the American press, just focuses on the negative in Honduras, which is, of course, what the press usually does. And, you know, this is good news out of Honduras. This is something positive. And the fact is that Honduras is a beautiful country with a wonderfully warm people, gorgeous landscapes and amazing beaches and just incredible reefs, coral reefs, tropical reefs. So, you know, and also wonderful and interesting archaeological sites. So the president was very happy that Honduras could give something to the world that wasn't just more stories of drug violence and corruption and that sort of thing.
Hmm. The book is called The Lost City of the Monkey God, A True Story. My guest has been Douglas Preston. It's a smart, thoughtful book, and it's also a wild, well-written ride. Douglas Preston, be well, and thanks so much for your time today.
Well, thank you. It's been great to be on the show.
Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Jennifer White is an artist and gallery owner. The last time we talked with her on the program, she had just announced the future opening of Post Pilgrim Gallery in Sioux Falls as a place where contemporary Native artists and visions could thrive. A year later and some change, the gallery is going strong. If you open the pages of this month's South Dakota magazine, you'll find a story by Paul Higbee about artists forging new ground and naturally, peace includes Jennifer White. She's back with us today.
Thanks, man. That was nice. That was super cool. Thanks.
We're live from the studios at the University of Sioux Falls. Jennifer, welcome back.
Thanks, man. I love you. Thank you.
The gallery is beautiful.
I've been there.
It is what strikes me about this gallery. If you haven't been there, it's on East 10th Street in Sioux Falls in the last stop. CD Shop building is that not only is it a gallery that displays great art, but it's a working, vibrant, breathing, living space.
Yeah.
Is that your intention when you started, that it would feel?
Absolutely. I think the best part about it, though, is watching it grow. Like giving, it's kind of like having a baby, really. Like you get to nurture and like see it grow, and now it's its own living thing, and it's beautiful. And when people walk in there, you can see it. You can see how much they appreciate what's going on in there. It's cool.
Is it bigger than you thought? I don't mean space-wise, but I mean...
Overwhelming? Absolutely.
Yeah, it's a little more...
Absolutely, yeah.
What are the things that surprised you about starting your own gallery and watching it develop like that?
How much you learn you don't know. Like, going in all cocky, like, I got this for sure. And then you get in there and it's a whole new world, and it's a whole different thing being a businesswoman and an artist at the same time, and kind of seeing them intertwine in each other and how it affects each aspect of who I am as a person. It's cool. It's overwhelming, but it's good.
How has it changed your work as an artist? Has it interfered with it? Has it made you more creative?
Oh, man. The people that come in there, they open up a part of them. They let you see into their soul for just a minute, and it feeds me. It's beautiful. And to be able to interact with just anybody, any random that comes in, it's awesome because they never expected That's the first thing some people say. They're like, I did not expect this to be this, to be like this. And it's like, yeah, welcome, man. Sit down. You want to talk? But it's feeding off of that energy that helps create a whole new avenue of thought and process in my work. It's cool.
I'm going to ask you to brag a little bit because over the past year of following your work, you've been a lot of places.
Yeah.
You've gotten a lot. I mean, every time I'm on Facebook, I see Jennifer, you know, was awarded or recognized for something else. Do you want, give me a highlight of one of those events over the past year that where your individual art has been featured somewhere or has been awarded something that sticks out as a particularly humbling moment for you. Sorry, put you on the
spot.
No,
man, you're cool. It was Washington, D.C., man. Yeah, I did this really radical piece with the Cleveland Indians Chief Wahoo on it, and it was kind of a riot piece. It was a really groovy piece, man, and this old chick came up to me. She had been like 82, and she takes her arthritis-ridden hand with her finger and says, I want that one. And I was like, are you serious? And she said, absolutely. I said, all right, you're kind of a riot girl. And she said, well, I wasn't born this old. And, you know, that's so cool, you know? Like, you really do. I'm constantly amazed by how much I learn from people every day. I'm a student every day. I get taught lessons every day. It's nice.
I think
that was cool.
I think all our listeners have an understanding of Chief Wahoo and the logo of the Cleveland Indians and the controversy that's surrounding it. But I want to know what, you know, what does art have to offer specifically to a conversation like that?
Oh man, right now it's a rebel based period, and what a wonderful time for artists to take advantage of that. And in the realm of the art scene, we get a liberty to say and do things that people would love to be able to share. And like seeing young artists and even older artists take advantage of that by speaking about what's going on in the world right now through their work is beautiful. And it's a platform where it opens conversation. It's not like being in a town hall meeting. This is a place where you can see and experience artwork with an artist and talk about politics and religion. And it's an open, honest discussion. There's no agenda.
Yeah,
it's beautiful.
If you're just joining us, my guest is artist and gallery owner Jennifer White. The gallery is Post Pilgrim in Sioux Falls. Even if you're not in Sioux Falls, you can find her on Facebook, and often she'll post something, and within 5 seconds, it'll be sold at the bottom of it, where someone...
People are crazy, man.
So get it fat, you know.
That's cool.
You did a series recently that kind of explored some nude images of Native women.
Oh, absolutely.
And that can cause a stir in the art world. How come?
Well, I think... I don't know whether it's what's expected of us as Native artists by non-Native people, but sometimes that pressure comes from Native people by Native people. And it's kind of a strange position to be in, because you want to be respectful, but at the same time, you need to remember to be respectful of, you taught me how to be this brave. You taught me not to be afraid to do what I want to do. I don't mean any disrespect to anybody that doesn't appreciate nude Native women, but at the same time, it's because of big, strong people that you learn to take the rein and be strong and be brave and make that statement in your artwork. And depicting nude women is, it's beautiful. I mean, that's no new gig at all. And just transforming it to Native is an honor. I'm happy to do it. I think they're beautiful.
Where does that courage come from to sort of find your own, not only to do something that, you know, might be criticized or critiqued harshly, but to just find your own voice in the world of art right now, where, you know, you can go on social media and find so many different artists. South Dakota has such a rich artistic tradition. And then you come as a young artist and say, I have something to say, too.
Yeah.
Does that just take guts? Does it take what?
No. That comes from every single person that I meet. Single person that I meet teaches me something. And that part always has to be open. You have to, as an artist, you have to be open for criticism. You have to be open for the words that people want to say about you or your work, and people say, well, you're an artist, you got thick skin, you can take it. But it's like artists are probably some of the most sensitive, vulnerable people I know, and there's nobody more critical than themselves. But by learning from everybody and being a good student and listening first, I think that has helped me quite a bit personally. Mm. Going in with open ears and an open mind and asking questions, you know, when you don't understand something, and not taking everything for granted. It's awesome.
Yeah.
I'm honored. But it's everybody that I meet every day that makes me able to do what I do.
What are you working on this week?
Oh, man, I got this show coming up in Montana at Great Falls, and I've never been there before. So I really want to represent South Dakota with a bang. I want to do so well, especially, you know, as a Native woman, like, just go in there and knock some heads around. But I'm working on this this collaborative piece with Christy Schwebach. She does the metal work, and then I get a paint on top of it. And usually I don't collaborate with other artists because I'm too bossy and weird, but but yeah, I get to do the painting, and she does the metal work, and they're stunning. Mm-hmm. I won the best of show for the concept at Center for Western Studies. Thank you, Christy. You're awesome. No, it was cool.
What's next for the gallery?
Oh, man. I've got my birthday coming up next month for the gallery. I can't believe it. No, it's going to be great. And I kind of want to celebrate the people who have loved and supported Post-Pilgrim since it was an idea. Yeah. And it's going to be a birthday party in every sense of the word. I want cake and balloons, the whole shebang.
All right.
Yeah.
We'll be there.
Yeah, man. It'll be cool. I'm excited.
Yeah. Jennifer White is an artist and gallery owner in South Dakota.
I love you, Lori.
South Dakota treasure. I'm going to go ahead and throw that out there. I came to see her in the gallery one day when I was having a bad day.
Oh, I love
you. Got
a
hug. Ended up with paint and love all over me.
Yep.
So I call you my friend. You can see her work at Post-Pilgrim Gallery in Sioux Falls on East 10th Street. It's inside the Last Stop CD Shop, and you can read more about Native art and artists in a feature called Horse Nation, written by Paul Higby. It's inside this month's issue of South Dakota Magazine. Jennifer White, I love you, and thank you.
I love you too, man.
Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Kevin Wooster joins us this week to talk about a building in Rapid City that serves to drape hope over a situation that often feels hopeless. It's not the building that's exciting, of course, it's what's possible inside of it. Kevin Wooster is a journalist and writer. You can find his blog at sdpb.org/Wooster. Kevin, welcome back to the program.
Lori, it's great to be back, but I got to tell you, having me on the same show with Douglas Preston makes me feel insignificant on my writing and my outdoor adventures. Come on. Really?
We went a little long there. We're squeezing it today.
I'm knee-deep in Rapid Creek thinking it's a big deal, and you're talking about going to the Lost City the monkey got?
You know, Kevin, that I did not book that segment. Chris Loffrey and Steve Zwemke found that, and I looked at the book, and I was like, you've got to be kidding me. And then I got to the snake part, and I was like, really? I got to keep reading. It's a good
stuff.
I'll
read along as best I can, but, you know, I'm feeling
So let's talk about fishing in South Dakota. No, okay. But let's talk about the great writing that you have done on sdpb.org and I got our website wrong. I'm all flustered now.
I know how that goes.
Let's go to the Restoration Center in Rapid City and, an organization and a bunch of people getting together to sort of address a ongoing problem and find a workable solution. How challenging is that?
Well, it's been such a challenge here that Mayor Steve Allender, you know, who has experience both as a policeman on the beat and as a police chief and now as mayor, looking back over about three decades, said we've been in this situation all this time trying to figure out what to do with all these people that are in such pain and, you know, in such seemingly hopeless situations with addiction and homelessness and all the other issues that they face. And, you know, no real solution other than sort of this rotation, this terrible cycle that they get into of going through court, ending up on the streets, maybe going through a detox, which may or may not be what they need or want at that point, and ending up back in that cycle again. And it's costly. You know, it costs to take these folks to the emergency room where they end up sometime. It costs certainly to take them through jail, and jail doesn't help you know, hardly any of them. It makes things worse usually. So
and everyone seems to agree on that. I mean,
You know, I thought Chaz Jewett, she's a local native woman here in town who's very active in different movements, and I thought she put it so well when she said, "We're asking our police to be medicine men, and that's not their job, and they can't do that job. It's not working." And we do ask too much of them. And this restoration center is, they're calling it at this point, made out of which is under construction under the old NAU building by the county mainly, but the city's involved, and getting some nonprofits involved in this stage too, a $14 million effort that will provide 40-some safe beds. You know, get people off the streets, get them out from under the bridges, get them out of the horrible weather, save their lives sometimes, and just a warm, safe place to sleep. And when they get up in the morning, at very inexpensive way, you know, it's just a bed, it's just a safe bed. And maybe have a conversation about, are you ready to try and do something with your life besides this? And if they're not, you give them a sandwich and you shake their hand and wish them well, and they go out into another day alive and relatively well. And if they are, then they begin a process of referral and assistance. And it's stage one in what could be a two-stage program that hopefully will have another building in the future. But it's a very hopeful start.
Right. So it's a broad vision, too, when you mention stages, stage one, stage two. This isn't something that's trying to solve a problem, you know, for this winter or now. It's trying to really address it at a deeper interwoven level. That really impressed me about what you had written about them. A complex situation to help an individual change their lives, though.
Oh, gosh. You know, I wrote, I think, and we talked about a little bit, the two guys I gave a ride from the church, the cathedral, to the detox center. That's not where they wanted to go. They knew they had to stop drinking. They talked about that in the car. They want to stop drinking, but it wasn't going to be that night or that next morning. And so we run them through that process, and it costs a lot of money and takes a couple of beds of somebody that may be wanting to start the process or maybe is in more crisis. But they want help. They want a place to be, and they want a place to stay. And you know what? They want a handshake, and they want some friendship and support. And this is a beginning of a really, really, what I think could be a life-changing, community-altering effort here in Rapid City.
Mm-hmm. And yet there's this dead end, sort of, about people with chronic mental health problems or mental health crises. Oh. This isn't the place for them to go. Regional health isn't the place for them to go. That's a huge problem, sort of, on a daily basis.
It is, yeah, and there's some crisis beds that can help, you know, for a night, say. But with regional health is in a position where they don't feel they have the capacity and the resources to deal with, people with these severe mental health problems that could be dangerous to themselves, maybe even to others. And so they have stopped, doing that, and that means those people will go to almost certainly go to a jail. They may go to an emergency room and then a jail or a crisis bed and then the jail and then shipped to Sioux Falls, where there are those facilities in a hospital, or to the state hospital in Yankton, far away, but may leave them in jeopardy in the meantime, and you know may lead some to turn away if they know they're going to end up in jail, or people that might otherwise take them for assistance are going to end up in jail. So that's a related but in many ways separate issue that, again, the community, the mayor, the county sheriff, the police chief, and the nonprofits are going to have to get together and work with Rapid City Regional and whatever resources they can find to try and address that.
I'm talking with Kevin Wooster, and you can read his blog on SDPB's website. You head over to sdpb.org/Wooster. And Kevin, I'm going to make a quick transition to this other piece that's going up today, and we only have a couple minutes to sort of whet people's appetites. And this is a notion of an exploration of folks who are comparing Donald Trump to Governor Bill Janklow, former Governor Bill Janklow from South Dakota. And, you're the first person who's really dug into real deeply what the similarities and the strong differences are. What did you find out?
Well, I got this request from a Democratic friend, and I thought I kind of put it off because I thought, how can you win on this? Somebody's going to be mad about this. But there are some similarities. You know, I met Janklow in the 70s and knew him through his death, as both in coverage, and I worked for him for 2 years as a state development South Dakota tourism host and for writers and a writer and a photographer myself. And, you know, they were both firebrand. Trump's an outspoken guy. He's aggressive. He fights with the media. He hits back at people that criticize him. Janklow did all that. But I think in what I'm looking at in the blog is the similarities that they had, and there are some, and the things that were so much different about them. And I would tell you that one of the striking ones that all of us who know him would talk about is Janklow's unrelenting hunger for knowledge and for new information and to challenge the mind and to learn more about many things. And so far, I have not detected that in President Trump. Perhaps there's more there than I've detected so far. But we'll look at that. We'll look at the fights that Janklow had with the press compared to the fights that Trump has, and how they were the same and how they were different.
And a surprising apology as well.
Yes, well, which some people at New Janklow might believe that's not possible, but we're talking because Trump once said, no, he never apologized. Why would he apologize? He didn't have anything to apologize for. Well, Janklow did, and he knew that, and occasionally he would apologize, and I'm going to talk about that, too.
All right, you want to read that one, and we want to know what you think about that comparison and those differences between former South Dakota Governor Bill Janklow and our current president, Donald Trump. You can find Kevin Wooster's blog on the SDPB website. It's at sdpb.org, Wooster. Kevin, thank you so much. It is always a pleasure to talk to you and to read what you're working on.
All right, we'll see you later.